She was also a key leader behind Ghana's historic Women's Manifesto 2004 and served as convener of Net Rights between the year 2005 and 2009. She sits on regional and international advisory boards, including Energia and the African Women's Development Fund. In 2018, she received the Martin Luther King Jr.'s Award for Peace and Social Justice for her unwavering commitment to women's rights and social justice. Finally, her expertise spans gender equality, governance, climate justice, economic empowerment, and social inclusion. It is therefore most fitting that she chairs tonight's lecture on Beyond Empowerment, Ownership, Wealth, and Economic Justice for African Women. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm round of applause as we welcome our chairperson for this evening, Dr. Rose Mensah-Cutin.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much, my lady, my young lady, for those kind words, which was a little bit much than I expected. Again, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Young Women Congress Network, it is my absolute pleasure to be asked to chair the 10th anniversary public lecture on the organizational theme of Beyond Empowerment, Ownership, Wealth, Economic Justice for African Women. Before I begin, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our special guests and key stakeholders with us today. Please join me in welcoming all our distinguished senior officials, members of the diplomatic community, that is if they are here, leaders from Corporate Ghana, women's organizations, and other distinguished stakeholders. Allow me to give special mention to Her Ladyship Justice Sofia Akufo, former Chief Justice of Ghana. I think we all know that this is a distinguished and honorable citizen of this country who we would all want to be associated with. And she's actually here with her sister and other members of her family. Madam, we are very proud of you as a citizen of Ghana and as a woman. As we may be aware, we are gathered here today to participate in the 10th anniversary public lecture of the YAWC network. This public lecture, as has been said by the executive director already, is part of a series of events earmarked to commemorate the 10-year journey of the network. The lecture is also to be delivered by my colleague and younger sister, Mrs. Sheila Menka-Premo, who is the convener of the Affirmative Action Law Coalition, and who is also a distinguished legal practitioner who has, over the years, initiated and supported several courses in the legal, gender, and social justice field. So we have a distinguished speaker on the theme of the 10th anniversary celebration of this very important young women's network. In his welcome address, the executive director informed us that the network is a Pan-African organization established in 2016 to connect and empower young women of Africa and the diaspora. Its core principles include effective women's leadership, innovation, and community development. And interestingly, he has informed us that over the 10 years, they have established physical presence in 12 African and the diaspora areas as well. And the organization provides a platform for transforming lives, championing inclusive development through women's leadership. Now, over the course of this event, we are going to have the opportunity to hear more about the organization's achievements, we hope, over the 10-year period of its existence. He has already alluded to the numbers that have reached, but we know that numbers are okay, but it doesn't speak to the issues, especially those of us who are women. We want to see actual impactfulness in our lives as a result of the work of the organization. And we also want to hear about the challenges encountered and the plans they have for the future. We will also hear from others who have had a chance to engage with the network over the years, because I think partnerships and also other stakeholders have a way of engaging with such organizations, and their experiences are also useful for us in terms of learning and also joining in the movement. So my hope is that by the time we leave here today, we'll have new insights into the organization's contributions to women's rights work. We also hope that we will establish valuable networking opportunities with one another and develop renewed inspiration about what young women and men can achieve together when they work together to address social and gender inequalities. I think this is very important, because at the end of the day, if one person hears the message and is able to interact with others with that message, we have a multiplier effect in terms of the change we want to see. I therefore want to extend my deepest gratitude to the organizers and everyone who worked tirelessly to make today possible. Without further ado, I officially declare the 10th anniversary public lecture of the YAWC network open. Please enjoy the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doc. Another round of applause for Doc. And in her submission, she made mention of the importance of partnerships, and so we have partners coming up shortly. We would be hearing from Gridco. The Director for Corporate Strategy for Gridco should be here. However, Celestina Asigri of Gridco represents him. Let's put our hands together as she comes forward to speak as a partner.
Good evening. I stand on all existing protocols. I have the privilege of standing in for my director, Mr. Samuel Paul Akwa, who is Director of Corporate Strategy at the Ghana Grid Company Limited, Gridco, who is unable to join us. He extends his regards and apologies. I must admit, I'm stepping into rather large shoes, but I'll do my best not to trip. So please allow me to deliver his remarks. Chairlady Dr. Rose Mensah-Kutin, our distinguished keynote speakers, members of the diplomatic community, senior government officials, leaders from corporate Ghana, the York Network family, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It is a privilege to stand before you this evening on behalf of the Ghana Grid Company Limited, Gridco, as we join the Young African Women Congress Network in celebrating 10 remarkable years of leadership, advocacy, and impact. 10 years ago, York set out with a simple but powerful conviction that Africa's future is inseparable from the leadership of its own women. A decade on, with chapters across 12 countries, the conviction has become a movement. GRIDCO is honored to stand alongside as you mark this milestone. This year's theme, Beyond Empowerment, Ownership, Wealth, and Economic Justice, asks a necessary question. Representation is progress, but representation without ownership, access to capital, or a genuine seat at the economic table is incomplete. It is a theme that resonates well beyond this room, and one that speaks directly to the work we do at GRIDCO. As the backbone to Ghana's power delivery, GRIDCO exists to move energy reliably from where it is generated to where it is needed, powering homes, industry, and enterprise across the country. We understand, perhaps better than most, that infrastructure is never neutral. Reliable power determines whether a woman can run a business from home, whether a clinic can function through the night, whether a girl can study after dark. Economic justice is built, quite literally, on infrastructure that works for everyone. That is why our support for this lecture is not a one-off gesture. It reflects a wider commitment we are building internally, strengthening our ESG and sustainability agenda, broadening opportunities for women within our own workforce and supply chain, and ensuring our corporate social responsibility efforts translate into measurable outcomes for the communities we serve, not merely activity for its own sake. We are proud, too, that 5 women from GRIDCO join you today as participants, not simply as guests, but as future custodians of this conversation. We hope they leave this room not just inspired, but equipped. To the York Network and its executive chairperson, Mr. Daniel Osei Tufuor, congratulations on 10 years of purposeful work. GRIDCO looks forward to a continued partnership as we work together towards an economy in which ownership, wealth, and justice are no longer aspirations for African women, but they are lived reality. Thank you.
Let's put our hands together once again for her. GRIDCO, thank you so much for your partnership. The partners who are next to speak is the Tema Oil Refinery, and we have the Managing Director, Edmond Combat Esquire, who is here. Well, not yet. Maybe yet to join us. All right. We'll move on to take remarks from the former board chairperson and lead promoter of the Congress Network, Professor Akosua Adumako-Ampofo. Let's put our hands together as she comes to make some remarks on this very special occasion. Could we still do it until she gets here?
Good evening, everyone. I'm going to join those who spoke before me to also salute the former chair of council and former big woman, let me say. I don't know if I can add Obrim Pong to it. Her ladyship. Where's Daniel? Wait, there you are. Okay, all right. My son Daniel, I should say. for his, he's not a very huge person physically, but he has a huge vision, and he has brought this organization very far. And to all the members of the Young African Women's Congress Network, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished here, members of the press, I salute everyone. I think that you all's presence in this room is extremely important. It signals a certain commitment, and even if it doesn't signal it, by the time you leave here, you will be a member of the devout choir of women's empowerment, not just economic, but justice and all of that. Daniel reminded me a few days ago that we had first come up with a name for this Congress in a room in my home a little over 10 years ago. I'll not tell you the first name that he came up with, and I was like, no, that one, it will not work. Because Ghanaians like acronyms, and certain acronyms, when you put them together, they have other meanings as well. So if you're not careful, you might get into trouble. But 10 years is both a long time and not necessarily a long time. A lot has happened in the 10 years that York has been on the move. 10 years ago, we did not have something called trad wives, traditional wives, women who are advocating that women should be locked in domestic spaces. We did not also have a manosphere of men coming together to say that their woes in this world are because women are progressing. So sometimes, retired as I am, I feel like we've made a lot of progress, and in some ways we're moving backwards. And I feel sad when I look at some of our young women and what they are willing to give up because of pressures. And I feel sad when I look at our young men who are trying to push their sisters aside just because they feel that they are entitled to certain spaces and their sisters are not. I understand that in the first 5 years, about 50% of organizations set up collapse, and that only 34% make it to 10 years. So York has done something amazing to be in that 34%. Yes. And a big echo to Daniel and the team for everyone's commitment, zeal, enthusiasm, sacrifice that has brought the organization thus far. It hasn't been easy. There have been many challenges, financial particularly. And then the enemies of progress who do not want us to speak about the issues and to speak the truth. And then there are those people who masquerade as friends, are pretending, and they are not actually supporting. And there have been personal tragedies in lives of members of York. But there are so many things to celebrate. The organization started with 56 members in 2016, and there are over 2,000 today. Charlie, let's give them a hand. There are now 12 national chapters in Cameroon, Ethiopia, Kenya, Liberia, Malawi, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Uganda, Zambia, the UK and the US, and of course in Ghana. We have gathered in Abuja, Kampala, Kigali, Nairobi, and of course in Accra. And there have been too many distinguished speakers and women of substance, quote unquote, both from politics, academia, civil society, the NGO world, and business, who have graced York with their presence, their wisdom, their fortitude. And I am very proud to have been associated with this organization this long. As I bring my remarks to a close, I know that our chair and our keynote speaker are amazing women with a lot of experience. They have a lot to say and a lot to share, and that you will be very enriched tonight before you leave. We'll hear facts and figures, I'm sure. We'll hear of progress and maybe some backsliding. written a lot about women's economic empowerment and the struggles that women have had to go through and still go through a lot because our states don't support us. They're in many other jurisdictions, there's support for startups, for small businesses, and we know that a lot of those are spaces occupied by women. And sadly, many of our countries on the continent, we do not have that. But I do want to encourage all of us that we still need to hang in there, and we cannot hang up our gloves, and that there are too many issues for us to deal with, to think about our own myopic conditions alone, right? Whether we are old, whether we are young, whether we are men, whether we are women, whether we are rural, urban, whether we are so-called elites or we are poor, whether we are Christian, Muslim, or traditional worshippers, whether we are straight or non-binary or non-conforming in our sexualities, we are here to help each other. And so we have to move in solidarity. If we do not work in solidarity and we will put ourselves into boxes, we are not going to prosper. We will simply not prosper. I want to remind us, for example, these days we are saddened by what we hear going on in South Africa, right? And yet many of us know, and the older ones here were alive when countries like Ghana and Nigeria were supporting South Africa by bringing their citizens here for an education. But the frontline states like Zambia, Angola, Mozambique, and so on, they suffered seriously because the apartheid government will bomb them as they offer succor and space and a haven to people from South Africa. And yet they did that. And I want to mention an organization that I learnt about recently in South Africa. I'm looking for their name because I had written it down. Yes, they are called Ya Siya Fana Shonke. And this is a group, a women's group, a South African women's group, who are looking out for African migrants to make sure that they are not beaten, they are not killed, they give them a place to hide, they make sure they have food, they take them to the hospital. That's a South African women's group. And I think it's a reflection of the kind of solidarity that African women have constantly offered. Without their names on any plaques somewhere, without their names in the newspapers, quietly doing the work of keeping communities going. And I want to end with that charge to all of us, that we should keep that flame of solidarity burning. Unless we work in community, unless we see the humanity that we have in each other, it's not going to be good for us as people. The Akans have a saying, Benkum jari nifa. Nifa jari benkum. The left hand washes the right washes the left. Because we have to work together. And if we think that we are prospering, there's another account saying that, Emeritus, you may think that you are up here. Times change. Tomorrow you may be down there. And the person that you walk by will be the one that you are looking for to sustain you, to hold your hand, to lift you up. So I just encourage all of us to keep that spirit of sisterhood alive. Brotherhood, brothers, please work with the sisters. I say spirit of sisterhood because I see that solidarity spirit much more in communities of women than I see it in communities of men. So I will encourage the men to adopt that spirit to enable not only women to prosper, but our communities, our nations, and our humanity to thrive. And on that note, I go to York on where you have reached, and to all of you, and I wish us happy deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Prof, for reminding us that there is still a lot of work to be done. Another round of applause for Prof. We'll take a brief musical interlude from One Voice Choir. They'll just do a 5 minute rendition of some beautiful tunes as we prepare our hearts for the lecture. let's give it up for One Voice Choir Ghana. Thank you so much. We will now hear from a woman who is going to introduce to us.
Guests, ladies and gentlemen, our keynote speaker is a senior lawyer, development consultant, and human rights activist. She holds a law degree from the University of Ghana, Legon, and was called to the Ghanaian Bar in 1989. She also holds a master's in law, LLM, from the Georgetown University Law Center, Washington, D.C., in the United States of America in 1995, where she studied as part of the Leadership and Advocacy on Women in Africa, LAWA, component of the Women's Law and Public Policy Fellowship Program. She is the managing consultant of ALC Law Consult, a law firm in Accra that provides legal services in civil law, including corporate law, land securitization, and family law litigation. She is also a development consultant and has been involved in research on marriage laws and other family law related issues under the Legal Pluralism and Gender Pilot Project undertaken with funding from the German Development Corporation from 2007 to year 2011. She continued with the same project with World Bank funding under the Ministry of Lands from 2012 to 2017. She's been involved in the preparation of a number of policies, including a consultant for the development of a gender policy for the social service in 2011. The Justice for Children Policy of 2015, the National Gender Policy of 2025, among others. She assisted with the drafting of laws, including the Affirmative Action Gender Equity Act of 2024, Act 1121, and others. She has worked on the human rights aspects of harmful traditional practices at the African Union for GIZ in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia in 2013. She also lectures in family law at the Law Institute, a paralegal training institute in Accra. She has worked in ensuring that women enjoy their constitutional rights. She is the convener of the Affirmative Action Law Coalition, which pushed for the passage of the Affirmative Action Act of 2024. She led the coalition to submit proposals to the Constitutional Review Committee of Ghana for the amendment of the Fourth Republic Constitution 1992 to mandate gender inclusion in election in parliament. She is the president of the Ghana Bar Association's Women's Forum and a member of the Bar Council. She belongs to several human rights organizations, including LAWA, Ghana Alumni Incorporated, African Women Lawyers Association, Africa Leadership Initiative for West Africa, ALIWA, and Zonta Club, Ghana. Ladies and gentlemen, yours and mine, Sheila Minka Primo Esquire.
Church. The chairperson, Dr. Ruth Mensah-Kutin, my own big sister, Your Ladyship Justice Sufa Akufu, former Chief Justice of Ghana, and her sister, Mrs. Matilda Pressman, who are also here. I salute you. They are also my aunts, so I have to greet them specially. Professor Akosua Adomako Ampofu, the former board chair for the Young African Women Congress Network, the council members, the governing council members of the network, and distinguished members of the Young African Women's Congress Network, and I stand on all other existing protocols. Good evening to you all. It's both an honor and a privilege to join the Young African Women Congress, Network, as it celebrates a decade of investing in the leadership, potential, and aspirations of young African women. Anniversaries such as this are occasions not only for celebration, but also for reflection. They invite us to assess how far we have come, to acknowledge the challenges that remain, and perhaps most importantly, to consider what the next decade should demand of this great organization. Congratulations for your 10th anniversary, and I wish you more success in the coming years. Thank you for inviting me to participate in and to share my thoughts on the theme for the anniversary at this very important occasion. So the theme, as you've heard already, for this public lecture is Beyond Empowerment, Ownership, Wealth, and Economic Justice for African Women. It could not be more timely to have such a topic. And before I'll delve into the topic, I'd like to also thank my research assistant and lawyer, Becky Ahadi, who is here with us. She did the research for me and was very instrumental in this paper that I'll be presenting. Becky. It's good to acknowledge the young ones and to encourage them because they are going to fill our shoes very soon. Thank you very much again, Becky. So for several decades, the language of women's empowerment has shaped development discourse across Africa. Governments have invested in girls' education, expanded access to healthcare and access to education, promoted women's entrepreneurship, increased financial inclusion, and pursued legal reforms aimed at advancing gender equality. Civil society organizations have mobilized communities, challenged discriminatory practices, and advocated tirelessly for reforms that have transformed the legal and policy landscape. Development partners have also played their parts and invested significant resources in programs designed to enhance women's economic participation. These collective efforts have produced undeniable progress, and they deserve some recognition at a time like this. Yet, they also invite a more fundamental question, which is, has empowerment translated into ownership of resources? Because there's an important distinction between enabling women to participate in economic activity and ensuring that they own and control a meaningful share of the wealth that economic activity is supposed to create. A woman may be economically active and yet own no land. She may operate a successful business but lack the collateral required to expand the business. She may contribute substantially to the acquisition of family property, yet remain economically vulnerable upon divorce or the death of a spouse. She may spend a lifetime creating wealth and support others to create wealth without accumulating wealth of her own. It is this distinction that lies at the heart of today's discussion. Although I will draw primarily on Ghana's experience because it's a jurisdiction that I know most intimately as a lawyer, and also because I have had the privilege of participating in a number of advocacy processes that have shaped our legal reforms for the benefit of women. And in spite of this, this is ultimately an African conversation. Across our continent, our legal systems may differ, our customary practices may vary, and our policy priorities may not always be identical. Yet, the question confronting us is remarkably very similar. Many, many countries. Who owns land? Who has access to productive resources and capital? Who inherits wealth? Who bears the disproportionate burden of unpaid care work? Who participates in economic decision-making, and ultimately, who benefits from Africa's development. Ghana's experience, therefore, provides a useful lens through which we may reflect on what opportunities and challenges facing women across the continent. So I've divided my topic into a number of sub-themes. So I'll start off by situating the conversation, which is the background and structure of the lecture. So before proceeding further, it's good to clarify a few concepts that underpin the discussion. The first one is empowerment. It's a word that we all hear every day about. It's been widely explored within development scholarship. While the literature offers diverse perspectives, it's perhaps most useful to understand empowerment as both a process and an outcome through which individuals acquire the ability to make meaningful choices and to exercise agency over decisions affecting their lives. Building on this understanding, economic empowerment refers not only to increasing women's incomes, but to expanding their capacity to access productive resources, participate in markets, influence economic decision-making, and exercise control over the benefits derived from their labor. However, empowerment alone does not necessarily produce economic justice. Ghanaian feminist scholar Professor Dodie Chikata argues that inequalities in access to productive resources such as land, labor, and capital are embedded within broader social relations and institutional structures that continue to reproduce gender inequality. Economic justice, therefore, requires more than expanded opportunities. It requires transforming the legal, economic, and social systems that determine who owns productive assets, who exercises control over resources, and who benefits from economic growth. Closely related is the concept of wealth. Wealth is a simple word. I'm sure we all understand it. It's often mistaken sometimes for income, yet the two are fundamentally different. Income is what we earn. Wealth is what we own. Wealth comprises land, housing, businesses, savings, investments, pensions, shares, and other productive assets capable of generating long-term economic security and intergenerational prosperity. As Thomas Piketty has demonstrated, patterns of wealth ownership frequently reveal deeper and more enduring inequalities than income alone. Ownership, in turn, is not merely a question of legal title. Ownership is the ability to control, use, derive benefits from, and transfer productive assets. As another scholar, Amtia Sen's capabilities approach reminds us, development must ultimately be measured by people's substantive freedoms to explore meaningful choices over the resources and opportunities available to them. So these distinctions are important because they expose a reality that is often or sometimes overlooked. A country must succeed in producing empowered women. A country may succeed in producing empowered women while still failing to produce women who own wealth in meaningful and transformative ways. Another phrase that I'd like our endeavor to define is economic justice. It's a set of moral principles for building fair economic institutions, focusing on equal opportunity, fair wealth distribution, and equitable working conditions. Its ultimate goal is to provide every person with sufficient material foundation to live a dignified, productive, and creative life. It's against this background that I wish to explore this evening's theme. My objective is not simply to review the legal and policy reforms that have advanced women's rights, important as these reforms undoubtedly are. Rather, I hope to examine whether these reforms have translated into genuine economic ownership and to consider what must be done if Africa is to move beyond empowering women to ensuring that women own, control, and transfer wealth across generations and enjoy economic justice process. So this evening, I do not intend to merely celebrate how far African women have come, nor do I intend to catalog the many laws and policies that have been enacted in our pursuit of gender equality. Those are important conversations. But they are conversations we have had many times before. Instead, I invite us together to ask a different question. If empowerment has been our destination for the past 3 decades, should ownership become a destination for the next 3 decades? That is something that we should be considering. And to answer that question, I'll take us on a journey which I've arranged into four parts. First of all, I'll briefly revisit our history, not to dwell on the past, but to understand how customary norms, colonial legal systems, and deeply entrenched patriarchal structures shaped women's relationship with property, wealth, and economic decision-making in Ghana and across Africa. Second, we'll examine the progress we have made. We'll reflect on the constitutional vision of equality under our 1992 Constitution and consider the legal and policy reforms that have transformed opportunities for women, from the Intestate Succession Law of 1985, the Land Act of 2020, Act 1036, to the historic passage of the Affirmative Action Gender Equity Act of 2024. Along the way, I hope to demonstrate that these reforms did not emerge by chance. They are the product of decades of persistent advocacy by civil society organizations, women's rights movements, development partners, traditional leaders, academics, and committed citizens who refuse to accept inequality as inevitable. Thirdly, we will ask an uncomfortable but necessary question. Have these legal reforms translated into economic ownership? Have they enabled more women to own land, accumulate wealth, build businesses which are sustainable, inherit property, and create intergenerational prosperity? Or have we, in some respects, confused participation with ownership? We will consider the work that remains unfinished. We will examine the legal, institutional, and social barriers that continue to constrain women's economic agency, from discriminatory social norms and the unequal burden of unpaid work to limited access to productive assets, finance, and investment opportunities. We will also reflect on the reforms that remain outstanding, including the long-awaited Property Rights of Spouses Bill and the effective implementation of our existing laws. Finally, by the time I go through these four parts, if there is only one message that I hope you carry with you from this evening, it is this: empowerment opens the door, ownership gives women the keys, and economic justice ensures that these keys can never again be taken away. So I'll start off with the first part, the story we inherited, historical, legal, and social foundations of women's economic exclusion. So before we can meaningfully discuss ownership, wealth, and economic justice, we must first understand why these concepts remain so deeply gendered across much of Africa. Economic inequalities do not emerge in isolation. They are shaped by history, reinforced by law, sustained by social institutions, and over time become normalized through culture and practice. Consequently, any serious conversation about women's economic empowerment must begin by examining the historical structures that have influenced women's relationship with property, productive resources, and economic decision making. One of the enduring misconceptions about African women's economic history is that women were merely passive participants in economic life until the advent of modern development policies. The historical evidence suggests otherwise. Across pre-colonial Africa, women were active producers, traders, farmers, processors, artisans, and entrepreneurs whose labor sustained households and local economies. In Ghana, for example, women played a central role in agricultural production, food processing, and trade. Among key ethnic groups like the Akans, the Gadangwes, and Ewes, women dominated the local markets and developed sophisticated trading networks that linked rural producers with urban consumers. I'm sure we are all aware of the market queen concepts. Have them market screen for plantain, for tomatoes, and for many producers. They emerged not merely as a commercial role, but as an important economic institution responsible for regulating trade, settling disputes, coordinating prices, and representing traders before traditional authorities. our sisters also from the northern part of Ghana have also been key players in the collection and processing of shea into butter, into farming, processing of foodstuffs, beans, groundnuts, dawadawa, among others. Indeed, some of Ghana's most influential historical figures, such as Nadede Ashikisham, the celebrated Ghana market leader. I think she's at the back of the 20 peswa coin, right? Or is it the 1 cedi coin? 20 peswa one. And later, the various Makola market queens demonstrated that women exercised significant economic influence within indigenous trading systems. Yet, influence within markets did not necessarily translate into ownership of productive assets, such as land or formal control over wealth. They also did not get the recognition required for the support that they provided during the pre-colonial times, I mean, pre-independence time, until much later. It is only recently that people like Professor Kosia Adomako and other colleagues have done a lot to showcase such women and the work that they did. This distinction between economic participation and economic ownership is one that continues to shape gender inequalities even up to today. Although women's experiences vary considerably across African societies, customary systems generally regulated access to land, inheritance, and family property through kinship structures. In matrilineal societies, including many Akan communities, succession to lineage property followed the maternal line. However, they did not necessarily confer equal proprietary rights upon women. But women belong to the lineage through which property devolves. Authority over lineage property was frequently exercised by male family heads or lineage elders. Conversely, in patrilineal societies, women's access to land was often mediated through fathers, husbands, and other male relatives. Consequently, women's security of tenure frequently depended upon family relationships rather than legally enforceable ownership rights. It is therefore inaccurate to portray pre-colonial Africa either as wholly egalitarian or wholly oppressive. Rather, women's access to economic resources was shaped by diverse customary systems that simultaneously created opportunities and also imposed restrictions or constraints on them. As Professor Tetua Menu observes, gender relations in Ghana have always been historically contingent and socially negotiated rather than static or uniform. The colonial period fundamentally altered these relationships. Colonial administrators introduced statutory legal systems that existed alongside customary law, creating a plural legal order that persists in many African countries today, including our own country. While colonial governments often claim to preserve customary law, they simultaneously codified and formalized customary institutions in ways that frequently privileged male authority. Chiefs and male lineage heads increasingly became the recognized custodians of land in their dealings with colonial administrations, thereby reinforcing male control over customary land administration. At the same time, colonial economic policies were largely designed around the assumption that men were the primary economic actors within the formal economy. Men were more readily incorporated into wage employment, commercial agriculture, and formal education, while women's economic contributions remained concentrated within subsistence agriculture, food production, informal trade, and unpaid household labor. Ironically, these sectors continue to sustain our economies without attracting equivalent legal recognition or institutional support. These historical developments have had enduring consequences. Professor Joji Chikata argues that questions of land, labor, and livelihoods cannot be understood simply through individual experiences, but must be analyzed within broader social relations that determines access to productive resources and opportunities. Gender inequalities, she argues, are embedded within institutional arrangements governing land, labor, and markets, and continue to shape livelihoods across sub-Saharan Africa. These observations resonate strongly within the Ghanaian context. According to the 2021 Population and Housing Census, women constitute slightly more than half of Ghana's population and remain highly active within agriculture, commerce, and the informal economy. Yet despite their extensive economic participation, studies consistently demonstrate that women continue to experience comparatively lower levels of ownership of land and other productive assets. Customary land tenure systems, although dynamic and evolving, continue in some instances to present barriers to women's independent access to land, particularly where inheritance practices and community norms favor male ownership. It's important to emphasize that these inequalities are not sustained by law alone. They are also reproduced through social norms and gendered expectations regarding the roles of women and men within families as well as communities. This broader system is commonly described as patriarchy in some way. So patriarchy should not be understood simply as a dominance of individual men over women. Rather, it refers to a system of social organization in which power, authority, and control over resources are disproportionately concentrated in male hands and reproduced through institutions such as the family, religion, customary practices, education, and even economic markets. Professor Akosua Adomakwa-Pofo has also argued that gender inequalities are sustained not only through formal legal structures, but also through everyday social practices that shape expectations regarding leadership, authority, work, and family life. The implications for women's economic empowerment are profound, basically based on what I have said. When women have less secure rights to land, they are less able to use land as collateral for credit. For women's contributions to unpaid care work remain largely invisible, they accumulate fewer savings, pensions, and productive assets over their lifetimes. When inheritance systems continue to privilege male ownership, wealth becomes concentrated across generations in ways that reinforce existing inequalities. This is why the conversation about economic justice cannot be reduced to questions of income alone. As economists increasingly recognize, wealth inequality is often more persistent than income inequality because wealth is accumulated over generations and transferred across families. Ownership of productive assets, particularly land, housing, business, and financial investments, provides not only economic security, but also social status, bargaining power, and political influence. These historical realities also explain why legal reform became necessary. The historical realities outlined above help explain why by the latter part of the 20th century, gender equality could no longer be viewed merely as a social aspiration or a matter of development policy. It had become a question of law, constitutional governance, as well as justice. The framers of the 1992 Constitution recognized that formal equality alone would be insufficient to address generations of structured disadvantages. Consequently, the Constitution does more than prohibit discrimination. It adopts what constitutional lawyers describe as an approach to substantive equality that acknowledges that historical inequalities require deliberate legal and policy interventions to achieve genuine equality in practice. For instance, Article 17(1) of the 1992 Constitution provides that all persons shall be equal before the law. 17(2) further prohibits discrimination on a number of grounds, including gender. Then 17(4) indicates that where it is found that historically there's been discrimination against one gender, then Parliament has the right to enact laws that are reasonably necessary to provide for the implementation of policies and programs aimed at addressing social, economic, or educational imbalance in Ghanaian society. So the Constitution itself recognizes that discrimination has a historical element to it, and therefore it's very clear in its language. Again, Article 24 of the 1992 Constitution is on the recited economic rights and states as follows. Every person has a right to work under satisfactory, safe, and healthy conditions and shall receive equal pay for equal work without distinctions of any kind. Yes, income, I mentioned, is necessary. It's not wealth, but income is also important. And there's also income discrimination.
Highlighted acute structural vulnerabilities within a number of member states and that security conditions in some contexts were deteriorating rather than improving. The threat of terrorism within the Sahel region was mentioned. Unconstitutional changes of government was also identified as another challenge, and entrenched civil wars. And you know something, from where I am right now in Libya, One of the things that strikes me is that the rate of regional integration among criminal networks and terrorist groups is expanding faster than it is among member states. And that should be a cause for concern, because it means our institutions are having to play catch up, and we're not doing it very well. So what I've just described for you should tell you that this is something that should engage all of our attention, because it's a new normal we don't want to live with. And so we very much look forward to the efforts of Special Envoy Bevlolate protecting us from the implications, at least within the confines of our country, Ghana. And so unless we have a concerted effort to support the states under terrorist threat, to reestablish state authority, address the root causes of their crisis, the threat will not only persist, it will continue to spread. And let us remember that the technologies that we have become used to using, right? AI, apps, cryptocurrencies, and for terrorists and criminal networks, the dark web, are just as available to them as they are to us. And given a situation where they are working together much more closely, they have the ability to be several steps ahead of state institutions in the way in which they deploy their capacities. And we saw that recently in Mali. With because to have that many simultaneous attacks happening in different cities at the same time is something that shows a level of planning and coordination that was previously unknown to these groups. If that is our new normal, then we've got to think about how we deal with this in a very proactive manner. In addition, we've got to focus on post-conflict recovery. A lot of the work that I've done over the last couple of years has not just focused on negotiating peace agreements, but making sure that those peace agreements are implemented. Because when we don't focus on post-conflict recovery, and we expect that these very fragile states are going to somehow manage to pull themselves out of the quagmire, settle, and be able to resume their path towards development, then we are expecting miracles of countries where institutions have collapsed, where capacities no longer exist, and where they will be unable to do that without sufficient support. And so, in that context, I think it's important for us to recognize that solidarity, not just speaking solidarity, but really acting solidarity, focus and implementing policies and programs with the emphasis on implementation, and not just saying that we have announced these things, is going to be what we need to be doing much more of going forward. And prioritizing inclusive governance in our multi-ethnic, multicultural contexts has to be the priority of every African Union member state. Because without that, given the artificiality of our borders, how do we expect to sit there united and peaceful? So what does this mean for Ghana? I listened to the mid-year review of the budget by the Finance Minister, Honorable Dr. Atu Forson, last week. And I was greatly encouraged, I must say, by his optimistic assessment of the future economic prospects of our country due to the efforts that have been made over the last year and a half. But nonetheless, as I listened to him, I was thinking to myself, this positive trajectory requires efforts at insulating the economy as much as is possible from external shocks. And the way in which we advance our foreign policy interests will either complement or have a minimal impact on building our needed resilience. And I think that one of the things that happens in Ghana is that we take so much for granted. And we believe that we have been peaceful, we are peaceful, we will always be peaceful. The examples of our neighbors should tell us that that is not the case. We cannot take our peace and security for granted. And we should not assume that because we haven't been hit by those kind of conflicts yet, it will not happen. The most painful thing when you have seen countries in conflict is the amount of destruction that has taken place to infrastructure that you know has been built on the back of extensive borrowing. And so you have a situation where the infrastructure that has been constructed and not yet paid for is already destroyed, and you're wondering, how are they going to get new money to be able to do that all over again? And how long is it going to take for them to get there and to be able to achieve the level of development that they previously had and then be able to build on that to move forward? So the fact that we haven't had it is a blessing, but I want to emphasize that peace building, even within a national context, should be seen as an investment that we must be making on a continuous basis. It's like a garden. You need to tend to it in order to make sure that the weeds don't overrun it and create conditions that we may not be ready to live with. Because we must also recognize that while it's very exciting to have significant foreign policy achievements that are big announcements about initiatives and, you know, programs that we are working with, and I'm sure Ambassador Say and all of the colleagues from the Foreign Ministry know this, the grunt work of making sure that the things that we agree on actually transform into workable programs, projects, and initiatives at the national level require as much time and attention as the big ticket items. Otherwise, we are never going to be able to achieve those benefits. And that brings me to the way in which we work within government. We need a whole of government approach to foreign policy. It should not just be an issue for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Regional Integration. The ministry is not an island that stands on itself, excluded from the rest of the government machinery. Because when you have a situation where you've got our diplomats and sometimes very dedicated, conscientious foreign service officers who are working in their country context to promote Ghana as an investment destination, to make sure that different ministries, departments, and agencies are notified and prepared for big meetings and discussions that are coming up, who follow through when you are not there to follow through? If there is not an effective coordination mechanism with the rest of government, how do we expect to achieve the benefits of that effort? And if we take the reports that come from the embassies as regular reports that are just stacked and put aside and nobody really reads them and focuses on what they say, what do you expect to get out of it? The most depressing thing, I think, for our Foreign Service officers is when they put all of that effort into trying to alert people at home to what is going on, and it becomes another email or it becomes another report on a desk that never even transfers from one ministry to another, let to talk about another institution that has the responsibility of implementation. And then the question is, with that investment that we are making in diplomatic presences, are we reaping the returns of our investment? And I would like to suggest that this is something that we'd certainly have to take more seriously and have inter-institutional, which means ministries, departments, and agencies, effective coordination platforms to plan, not just to go and attend and participate, but to come back and review and make sure that we focus on implementing. These are basics. And they're really not things that I should be standing here on